Good morning, everyone. We welcome you to our Sunday morning roundtable discussion with the subject of everlasting punishment, everyone's favorite. And we're so glad you could join us today. We are recording from the Plainfield Christian Science Church Independent, Plainfield, New Jersey, in the United States of America. And we welcome you all. And we will begin with our morning prayer.
I'm reading pages, excerpts from 278, 245, and 279 of Miscellany. The government of divine love is supreme. Love rules the universe, and its edict has gone forth. Thou shalt have no other God before me, and love thy neighbor as thyself. Let us have the molecule of faith that removes mountains, faith armed with the understanding of love, as in divine science, where right reigneth. Let the voice of truth and love be heard above the dire din of mortal nothingness, and the majestic march of Christian science go on ad infinitum, praising God, doing the works of primitive Christianity, and enlightening the world. God is Father, infinite, and this great truth, when understood in its divine metaphysics, will establish the brotherhood of man and wars, and demonstrate on earth peace, goodwill toward men. Mary Baker Eddy.
Beautiful, thank you. Okay, Karen, the watching point.
Watch number 41. Watch lest you believe that in certain directions, Christian science does not condemn what the world calls sin, because it encourages that dissatisfaction with mortal existence, which often leads mortals to sin. Jesus said, I am come not to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance. Evidently, he felt that the consciousness in which the seeds of sin had developed and borne the fruit of suffering was more receptive to truth than the one that contained in embryo seeds, as every mortal consciousness does, where because they had not ripened into action, mortal man believed that he was more or less free from sin, and hence righteous. No one seeks truth until he feels that he needs it. One cannot declare that he is righteous until he has cleansed his thought of all materiality. The self-satisfied or self-righteous mentality is not open to the approach of Christ, truth.
Thank you. And comments on that?
Well, that certainly was addressed yesterday in the Bible study.
Thank you, Tom, for that wonderful Bible study.
Yeah, self-righteousness is not good. And it does harden thought. And also, in the book that I was referring to, it really does stop spiritual inspiration. And if one's wondering, like I have on occasion and heard many others and still do sometimes, why do I not hear God, or why do I not feel spiritual? You know, the spiritual sense, well, there's the answer right there. It's our, and so that's been a big lesson for me.
Thank you. I don't want, maybe you should mention about a little bit about what you mentioned yesterday.
It's in Law of Love by Ann Beals. And she talks about the degrees, like Mrs. Eddy talks about the degrees of mortal mind in science and health, which she calls the first degree depravity. And she lists some of those traits, and one of them is self-righteousness. And in Ann Beals' book, she lists no less than 47 of them. But one of them, she had a wonderful definition of self-righteousness. And I read it yesterday. I don't know if you want me to read it again or part of it, but it really just nailed it right on the head.
Read part of it.
Okay. The self-righteous individual is convinced he's always right. He may even take a martyred attitude that his role in life is to straighten everyone out. He can never admit to being wrong or making a mistake. He can be narrow-minded in what he considers to be right, intolerant of any differing views, and even belligerent with those who hold them. When a person has this false trait, his mind is impervious to divine ideas, for the purpose of spiritual unfoldment is to correct wrong thinking. And one who is always right cannot even admit that such correction is needed.
Thank you. Really, when, you know, we're asked to examine ourselves each day and create in me a clean heart, you can look for that. Make sure that it creeps up on you. You start thinking you know so much. And in all the stories in this lesson, they're all about having this humility, right? And that certainly in the story of the Pharisee and the publican.
Yeah. Which is why they wanted to get rid of him, because he was holding that in their face and they didn't like it. So they had to get rid of it.
So anybody knows some best prayers for that? I truly am dealing with someone exactly like you described. So I'm just asking a good prayer suggestions. We know many, but just in case.
The psalm is good. Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me.
Prayer is only going to improve you.
You're saying you're seeing this in someone else? Is that what you're saying? Yeah. Okay, well, again, it's in your thought, so you have to correct your own thought about it.
Love and, the hell out of them.
What's that?
Love the hell out of them.
Love the hell out of them. That's what Rich Carey would say. Love the hell out of them. Don't get affected by it.
Another thing this watching point addresses is the issue of judging. It's a rebuke to judging. And some people might think, oh, this person's sinning and he's not getting the punishment he really deserves. Well, who's going to be making that kind of criteria for somebody else? You know, the person is going through. And after all, it's God who is in charge. He's the one who executes his justice. And our point is just to get ourselves right with him and allow his spirit to move us and not be so critical in judgment of others.
Thank you. You know, you never see Jesus really rebuking the so-called sinner. It's always the self-righteous that he rebukes.
It's no wonder that Mrs. Eddy said that the Sermon on the Mount, if read every week, that would be enough.
Yes.
Because the Sermon on the Mount covers everything.
Yes. Yes. And, you know, if we all just work on ourselves, then the world would be a better place. I'm so quick to see things in others. Now, when you do, and if there does seem to be some kind of a problem, what we've been taught here, you separate the error from the person. The person is God's perfect loving child, and you love that perfect loving child. The error, however, you do have every right to rebuke. Whether you do it to the person itself, always going after the error, or whether it's just in your own thought. But you do it from love. And if you do it to your own self enough, you will see the errors that bother other people, and you won't be able to tolerate them.
In yourself.
In yourself or in others.
And we still have to uncover error, right? And that's not judging, it's just realizing or uncovering that something needs to be healed or corrected in thought there, right?
That's
not judging.
Well, yes. It's not judging people, no.
Yes.
But it's judging righteous judgment, to judge false beliefs and errors that are maybe, you know, entrapping people.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay to hate evil.
Mm-hmm. You will.
But not persons. No.
Yes. If you love God, the error becomes more and more obnoxious to you. That's just what happens until it finally disappears into its native nothingness. And Mrs. Eddy says that. Yeah. Go ahead, Bruce.
And what you said is absolutely correct. Error needs exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Salvation is all to bring it out of light. And the way the error appears to succeed is in secrecy. And that's a secrecy that must be broken.
Over and over, Mrs. Eddy talks about that, rebuking the error. In Science and Health, in her chapter Prayer, she talks about divine severity. Jesus uncovered and rebuked sin before he cast it out. Of a sick woman, he said that Satan had bound her, and Peter, he said, "Thou art an offense to me." He came teaching and showing men how to destroy sin, sickness, and death. He said of the fruitless tree, "It is hewn down." But again, it is never the person you love. That's why you do it. But an error likes to operate in secret. So sometimes you have to bring it up. It's not sometimes the happiest thing to do, but in a way it is, because it's like a clearing the air,
yes,
like a thunder burst.
Sometimes I think if you do clean yourself, your thoughts right about and love them, that they'll recognize. Sometimes they're blind to it. And
they are. Most likely they are blind to it. Blind. In a beautiful article that Carrie sent called A Sin and Sinner, this is from an 1890 issue of the journal, WFG. The excerpt is, "The scribes and Pharisees were asleep in error, satisfied to remain as they were. Jesus loved them and would save them. He loved not the sin of the hypocrisy nor the dream of materiality, but he loved the individual. They did not know the terribleness of their condition. They did not realize how far they were from truth. Jesus had for them something better, but they must see their need of it before they would accept it. Hence, he must first cause them to see they were in error. For this, he said, 'Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees and hypocrites.' He showed them the errors they indulged and the terrible consequences that must inevitably follow. Then he adds, 'Ye serpents, ye generations of vipers, how can ye escape the damnation of hell?'" You said that was pretty rough. Were these the words of love? Yes. And given in the spirit of love that knows no hate. They were truth's denunciation of error. While Jesus possessed undying love for the sinner, he was unrelenting towards sin. The purity of his thought made his rebuke all the more terrible. But the design of love is to what?
Form the sinner.
As the drowning man suffers when being brought back to life, so the sinner suffers under truth's denunciation of error. The suffering of mortal thought, when rebuked by love, serves to destroy the sin, but saves the individual, revealing him as the image and likeness of God. And as we talked about yesterday at the Bible study, some of these so-called sins, I mean, they're not big, obvious ones, even like self-righteousness. Some of them are lesser ones where you're just indulging and listening to the wrong voice or whatever it might be. But if it needs to be rebuked, then it needs to be rebuked. And then it should go, because it was never the truth about the person in the first place. Just false beliefs that they're buying into. So, anyone else?
And you can see the difference in
chosen with between Jesus and the Pharisees. The Pharisees just hated the common man, it seemed. Most of them, anyway. Most of the Pharisees.
A lot of them.
They just.
Some of them got it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it brings that out, too. There were some that did get it, but then the ones that didn't, you think, good night. How could that happen? So.
You just call them my friend.
He did. Yes, he did. He was a friend. Go ahead.
Maybe the tricky part is, I think Jesus judged from the divine plane out, and we sometimes we judge from our human plane, and it's always easier to see the wrong in other than in oneself.
Yes.
So to have this love and to really do the rebuke mentally or verbally with this love, I find this is a challenge and a daily task for me.
Good, and that's very important. And this is certainly not just being about humanly critical. And this is something that comes over time as you grow in the truth, the error, you see the error more clearly, it becomes more obnoxious, it must be rebuked, only so you can save the individual child of God. But it's not about going around criticizing people.
That's a very good point to have, because Jesus beheld the perfect individual, the perfect man, the perfect all of us. So there was no ego in that story. And so this has been a very beautiful acknowledgement of this.
Thank you. Yeah, and that's what caused him to jump to it, because he did see the perfect man, the beautiful man, and you don't want to see that beautiful man going down the wrong road. So yes, and that beautiful prayer in this week's lesson, wash me thoroughly from mine iniquity and cleanse me from my sin. Behold, thou desirest truth in the inward parts. Create in me a clean heart, O God, and renew the right spirit within me. Such a beautiful, beautiful prayer. Then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. So after you cleanse your own thought, that you can do this to help others. So, and what we're discussing now is how to keep yourself and others from having this belief of everlasting punishment, of this droning on of beliefs and fears and negativities that would try to keep a person in everlasting punishment.
I would like to share that about what was said before, that praying for this individual divine mind led me so beautiful to something that we work all the time with, that is 111. And it was so wonderful to do one creation, one creator, one individual, all and only good. And I just kept on praying all the time with that, and divine mind led me so beautifully to just see perfection. I'm so grateful.
Thank you.
And really, the belief that there is everlasting punishment is a belief that God knows evil and punishes.
Right.
Whereas, in fact, we've learned God does not know evil. God is 100% good. And evil can only destroy itself. And divine love loves you enough to bring evil out in the open if it's in your face or in your conscience or in your existence anywhere. And it brings it out in a way that enables you to see its nothingness and thus destroy it in your consciousness. And sometimes it's sometimes it's a painful experience.
Mm-hmm.
Most times it is. But that's because, what does Mrs. Eddy say? To suffer for sin is God's way of destroying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she also said that the pains of sense are salutary if they wrench away false pleasurable beliefs.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, so if you're having that kind of a struggle, rejoice. You're being purified. And the dross is being cleansed, and the gold is going to come out and shine all the more brighter. All right, Nancy, what did you send me this week?
Yes, I found in Prose Works, Mrs. Eddy's message for 1901. She wrote a little bit about future punishment of sin. She says, "My views of a future and eternal punishment take in a poignant present sense of sin and its suffering, punishing itself here and hereafter till the sin is destroyed." And then she goes on, "The present self-inflicted sufferings of mortals from sin, disease, and death should suffice so to awaken the sufferer from the mortal sense of sin and mind and matter as to cause him to return to the Father's house, penitent and saved, yea, quickly to return to divine love, the author and finisher of our faith, who so loves even the repentant prodigal, departed from his better self and struggling to return, as to meet the sad sinner on his way and to welcome him home." And I thought that went beautifully with Isaiah from our responsive readings. "Let the wicked forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon." And from a Bible commentary, "In a profound invitation for reconciliation, this verse highlights God's readiness to accept those who have strayed from him. The context emphasizes the use of repentance, not as a prerequisite, but rather as a natural outflow of genuinely seeking the Lord. This passage reassures that returning to God entails leaving behind one's wickedness and unrighteousness, and as he stands ready to respond with mercy and abundant pardon to all who sincerely seek him. The focus is on the heart's posture of turning back to God, rather than the necessity of prior reform. The call to forsake one's ways and thoughts is not merely a hard command, but an invitation to find joy and peace in a restored relationship with the Creator. This segment of Isaiah serves to remind us that God's plans and thoughts are infinitely higher than our own, highlighting the transformational power of divine grace for any returning sinner. Thus, the promise of pardon is extended without bias, echoing the theme that no one is beyond the reach of God's compassion."
That's beautiful. Thank you.
Thank you.
I love that. It's not a hard command, but an invitation to find joy and peace and a restored relationship with the Creator. You know, if Mrs. Evans hadn't come after me the way she had, I would have never found the peace and joy that I now have. Because no one really cared enough or maybe knew enough how to do this mental anatomy. And I was miserable. And as I said yesterday, it was, you know, I didn't know I was sinning. It was because I was so negative and fearful and other things that were actually sin. And she would come after that until I finally saw how disloyal I was to God and how this was a sin. And in a beautiful definition that Thomas sent to us on Notes on Joel, where he gives a definition of repentance. And the first in theology, the pain, regret, or affliction which a person feels on account of past conduct because it exposes him to punishment. Okay. So maybe that's how I used to feel. I said, "Oh dear, I'm in trouble now and I'm afraid to get punished." Rather than instead, real penitence, sorrow or deep contrition for sin is an offense and dishonor to God, a violation of his holy law, and the basis in gratitude towards a being of infinite benevolence. I had to get where I felt that this really sorrow for what I was doing because it was dishonoring God, not because I was just afraid of getting in trouble.
Right.
And Mrs. Evans used to say sometimes when people would be carrying on that it was crocodile tears, right? Because they didn't mean it. They really weren't sorry. They were just sorry they got caught.
Yes.
It's like the parable of the judge that's only helping that lady because he doesn't want to be bothered.
Right.
Opportunity, is that it?
Yeah.
Opportunity.
Yeah. And you know, in the lesson this week, the golden text, search me, O God, and know my heart, try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way of everlasting. And then, let the wicked forsake his way, this is responsive reading, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. Now, you see, it's these thoughts, my friend, these thoughts. And we are either in the right mind or the wrong mind. And when the expression rouse ye, or to rouse yourself, is to get yourself out of the wrong mind. Because what is the human mind? What will it eventually do?
Kill you.
It will kill you. So you can't fool around with these depressing, fearful, negative, lusting, whatever the list is. You can't fool around with it. It is killing you, my friend. And that's why you end up taking drugs and other things, because you're miserable, as I was. So rousing yourself is getting you out of this blankety blank human mind. Okay. I'm refraining myself because this is not a good place to be. And so if you are feeling ungrateful, if you are feeling fearful, if you are feeling negative, if you're feeling useless, if you're poor me, whatever that is, rouse yourself out of it. And as we talked about last week, one of the wonderful ways to do that is what?
Sing hymns.
Yes, absolutely. Sing hymns. And what is that doing?
Lifting thought.
Yes, and to express joy and gratitude. That's why they're two essential ingredients to any healing. The joy and the gratitude. You've got to have it. And that is rousing your thought out of this human mind, which is killing you. Who wants to be killed? I don't particularly.
No. I think.
Go ahead, please. Yeah,
I also think that it's very important to have reference for the fact that there is only one mind.
Yes.
And she's not, you know, she didn't give the, you know, that daily treatment to really wake up every morning to acknowledge the fact that there is only one mind. And throughout the day, she says, you know, remind yourself that there is only one mind. This mind is the mind of Christ, and it's the only mind that I can have.
Yes. I have it in, I think, my Bible where she says that, yes, to acknowledge every day that this is only the one mind and all my moments are his. But then stay in that mind. It is the only one. And in the things to handle daily, which I love, one is the first thing in the morning, call on God to deliver you from temptation and help you to be awake. Then do your chores, not as a dreamy hashish eater, but with a clear sense of what to do and how to do it. Then sit down and first get yourself into a consciousness of your power with God, and then take up the outside watch. Sit until this is clear, if 2 hours. What do you think the outside watch is?
I thought it was for when I do the prayers for the children and the world and and understand that the safety of the child, there's one heart. That's what I thought the outward was after I do the inward.
Thank you. I agree. I don't know if anyone else is.
No, I think that's right.
Yeah, you first getting yourself straight, your power with God. Do you acknowledge your power with God? And then the second one after that one, things to handle daily. I want you to take up the watch every 2 hours, as long as you live, until you can make the right side real to your consciousness. And what is that right side?
God's side.
Spiritual fact at hand. The spiritual fact of everything in your experience. Everything in your experience is spiritual because it is of God. And anything that isn't will disappear. Once you get to the point where you recognize that the only thing that's real has its basis, has its substance in the spirit that is God.
Yes, you're just overcome with the omnipotence, omnipresence, omniscience of God. Now, there's no little inkling in you that thinks error has any power. You get into that feeling, yes, of power with God. It is God. It's not you, but it is God. And you work at that till you get it. And every 2 hours, and for the rest of your life, as long as you live, because it takes some work. And in Bichelle Young's rule, three rules for treatment. Rule number one is get a clear concept of God. Rule number two is get the clear concept of man. And then rule three, handle the beliefs only. In the realm of belief only can the evil so-called be handled. And then this is what Florence was saying. This is most important. There is no mortal mind. It has no sources, no origin, no power, no presence, no activity, no manifestation, and no law of enactment. There are not minds many. The false beliefs that there are or seem to be cannot operate to affect us in any way whatsoever. A false belief cannot operate by calling itself fear, envy, deceit, lust, hatred, jealousy, lack, pain, and so on. So this is our work, friends, and it's wonderful work. It's glorious work. What else is there to do but to really wipe out? And one time Mrs. Evans once said that's perhaps the hardest thing to do, as we've talked about it before, is to know there's only one mind, because we seem to see all these different people acting in odd ways or whatever. You got to get back to this. There is no sense. There's no mortal mind. There's only the one mind. And the more you know it, the more you declare it, you will have it and you will see it in others. In another, a beautiful article sent by Carrie, and I love this writer, The Healing Mind by Samuel Greenwood. He brings this out. Mrs. Eddy tells us that sick humanity looks for relief in all ways except the right one, science and health. Mortals examine the material body, watch its actions, regulate its food, and so on, instead of looking into mortal thought for their enemy and putting out what has no business there. It is obvious that trouble of any kind could not occur in human experience unless human thought had first made it possible. Nor could suffering result from any circumstance apart from mental action. Again, you've gone into the mortal dream, the Adam dream. You have to rouse yourself. Therefore, the potent remedy in sickness as in other errors is to obey the scriptural injunction of Isaiah. Let the wicked man forsake his way and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him, and to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. And then to quote Mrs. Eddy, the divine mind produces in man health, harmony, and immortality. So the whole article is very beautiful on the healing mind. So stay in that mind and you'll be fine. And if you're not, again, rouse yourself. Now I'm going to have Gary. Gary's made audios of recently that dear Julie Treadwell, our friend in Florida, who had been head of the Mary Baker Eddy Institute. Don't think she no longer is, but she strongly recommended the association addresses of Mildred LeBlanc. I think they're all under copyright, but we can pass them around anyway, I guess, because I don't, they're not published by the Publishing Society. And anyway, the one on joy, well, there's two, joy and enthusiasm. They're beautiful. The one on lack also, but I'm going to have Gary read the one on joy. And remember in Nehemiah 8, number 10, for the joy of the Lord is your strength. If you're not joyous, you're going to feel weak and miserable. Okay, I'm sorry. Let's have some joy. And what do they say? If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands. But if you're happy and you know it, let your face show it. Okay, Joy by Mildred LeBlanc.
She writes, joy is not a mental trimming to be put on or take off at will, nor is it fleeting or dependent on chance or circumstance. Joy is an essential and fundamental quality of divine consciousness. As such, it is something for us to demonstrate. Joy is a lubricator. It is necessary to put joy in the place of hard duty or responsibility. Thomas Carlyle has this to say of joy, quote, give us, oh, give us the man who sings at his work. He will do more in the same time. He will do it better. He will persevere longer. One is scarcely sensible to fatigue whilst he marches to music. The very stars are said to make harmony as they revolve in their spheres. Wondrous is the strength of cheerfulness, altogether past calculation in its power of endurance. Efforts to be permanently useful must be uniformly joyous. A spirit all sunshine, graceful from very gladness, beautiful because bright. End quote. Certainly, joy is a shining quality. One of our lecturers once put us to a real test in this way when he said, if you have not joy, we have not science. For the primal quality of this science is joy. Joy in God's perfect creation. Then the joy which comes from the appreciation of all things from the standpoint of mind, seeing mind's ideas, is real and enduring joy. We are naturally joyful as we are conscious of mind's ideas. The individual should never be without joy when he understands it in this way. No matter how little he may believe he possesses or understands these ideas, he has the opportunity to know what he has as real. To be joyful because man in the universe is mind manifested. Because they are real. Because they are here. And here and now are ours, yours, and mine. Divine consciousness is naturally a joyful consciousness. The joyful consciousness is a rich consciousness, and indestructibly rich because it perceives and understands mind's ideas to be omnipresent. In the parable of the rich man who stored up much goods, we learn that he lost his so-called riches because he was not rich toward God. Being rich toward God is to understand and, therefore, to have joy in the fact that man and the universe express mind. As Mrs. Eddy tells us, quote, The divine mind maintains all identities, from a blade of grass to a star, end quote. Joy plays an important part in the salvation of each one of us. With joy, quoting from a lecturer, fill ye, draw water out of the wells of salvation. There is no other bucket. In an excerpt from one of Mrs. Eddy's letters, which appeared in the Christian Science periodicals, we find that she had this to say about joy. Quote, so, dear friend, cultivate joy, hope, faith. Life lies before you glorious. Banish the shadow. Seize the substance. And God good is with you always. End quote.
I love that. And, you know, it doesn't matter where you are, who you are, what your situation is. You can express joy. Don't tell me you can't. I will not believe you. You can also express gratitude. I don't care what your background is. I don't care what your hovel you're living in or all your complaints. You can still express joy. Your joy, no man taketh from you, the Christ says. And we have a duty and responsibility to do that as reflections of God. You'll never get yourself out of a muddle unless you start somewhere, and you can start with that. And in that beautiful citation from Lamentations in the lesson this week about God's mercies are new every morning, and in another article that Carrie sent, The Eternal Mercy, it writes about that tender and clear like the early shining of the morning dew. The loving kindness of the Lord springs anew with each awakening. In that heart which turns to him for all that the day may bring forth. So there's a stipulation. Are you turning to him to see the beauty of his creation, which is everywhere?
And that includes you.
And that definitely includes you.
Because you are the manifestation of that God. I often think, you know, if someone doesn't have joy, I mean, it's hard to imagine not having some joy every day. But if someone doesn't have joy, it really is a sign that they've lost the concept of who they are. Really?
Yeah. Wrong mind.
Wrong mind.
Yeah. I mean, if you have even an inkling of the idea that, yes, you are the child of a loving and a perfect God. If you even have the hope of that, that is reason to be joyful and grateful. And if you really understand clearly that you are the manifestation of this God, boy, oh boy, do you have a lot to be grateful for and to be happy about.
It should definitely be a characteristic of a Christian Scientist to be joyful and grateful and spread this cheer wherever he goes, to have a cheerful word for everyone at all times and not a pruny face. Everyone needs a smile and a kind word, as my dad would say. You'd ask him what he wanted for his birthday, a kind and smile word. That's a kind word. So anyway, and everyone can give that. And not withhold it. And what is that quote of Mrs. Eddy that she talks about Christian Scientists having written by Bassett?
Oh, yeah, it was that Reverend Talmadge said that Christian Scientists had enduring wit, humor, and vivacity.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And a good sense of humor to be able to laugh at yourself first, and just see the humor of mortal mind. It's good to have a good laugh at mortal mind because it's quite ridiculous, and it's got a lot of jokes in there if you look for it.
And that's the one thing that evil hates more than anything else. It hates to be laughed at.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Mrs. Eddy says to keep your grin ahead of your groan. If you do these things, everlasting punishment, I mean, it doesn't exist. We know it doesn't exist. Mrs. Evans would call it everlasting love. Mm-hmm. And then one other quick thing that I love so much before I switch gears was where it says in the lesson about that you come to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels. That's where we come into, innumerable company of angels. Isn't that wonderful? Mm-hmm. And in another article by Ella Hogue, also from Cary, she talks about home and how our home should have angels dwelling within it. We should be accompanied by angels. And as I've told you, every day I work for my home, the peace of my home, the joy of my home, that everyone that comes in is blessed. And then, and that the angels, Gabriel and Michael, are in every room. They're everywhere. Mm-hmm. No place where any error is hiding or where anyone's listening to the voice of the devil instead of God's voice. Michael is there to enforce it with his mighty army. And Gabriel there with peace and love and joy. Enforce that in your home, and there will be nothing lurking around. Impossible. But this is joyous work to do. You know, I found it interesting in The Chosen, every time they leave their home, they always kiss the door or something. I'm sure they're blessing it.
Yeah, and when Jesus sent his disciples out, he said to Luke, the home, and I think that's what it is.
Yes. Bless your home, and no plague shall come nigh your dwelling. Nope. Or a sick plague, or a depressed plague, or a bug, or whatever else. You work with that 91st Psalm.
I heard Bill do that. Every time she leaves her house, she would pray about her house being safe.
And that's lovely, and that's what it should be. Now, quickly, I just want to get into something because, as we know, the elections are in a couple days, and most people are feeling it in various ways, and we must stay our course and do our work, and know that God is in control of the entire situation, as he always has been, and that our government is in control by God. I'm going to have Gary end on that. I think that's something that Nancy had given us a few weeks ago, called God is in control. But also, Parthens sent something to me, our dear friend Bob from
Colorado.
Thank you. He said, this is a text excerpted from a national fast declared by the Continental Congress on March 16th, 1776. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but in times of impending calamity and distress, when the liberties of America are eminently endangered by the secret machinations and open assaults of an insidious and vindictive administration, it becomes the indispensable duty of these hitherto free and happy colonies, with true penitence of heart and the most reverent devotion, publicly to acknowledge the overruling providence of God, to confess and deplore our offenses against him, and to supplicate his interposition for averting the threatened danger and prospering our strenuous efforts in the cause of freedom, virtue, and posterity. So it goes on, but it's just the idea of, yes, our repentance, our turning to God. Our song today is what, Bruce?
Breathe on us again.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it goes, O Spirit, send a revival to this nation.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and it you know, it really doesn't matter what the human government is. Most of it is unfortunately corrupt. So this is why we always need to be praying this for purification, on our knees to pray that God's government is in control, whoever our president or Congress is, and then to pray for them and to see them correctly. All this carrying on and all this hateful talk does no one any good. No one. So, and then in miscellany, Mrs. Eddy states, a small group of wise thinkers is better than the might of empires. God is brought together from, that's the end of the quote. And then actually this is from an article I wrote. But God has brought together from the very far corners of the earth a group of wise thinkers, a group dedicated to work day and night for the liberation of mankind from sin, disease, and death. And that is us, my friends. And then in the biblical story of Sodom and Gomorrah, Abraham's prayer was that if 50 or even 10 righteous men could be found in Sodom, that city would be saved from destruction. In regard to this story, Mrs. Eddy makes an interesting comment. A life or nation is saved in proportion to the predominance within of purity, patriotism, or other right motives. And this is the inner spiritual meaning of Abraham's petition to God. If Sodom City had in it enough moral worth, it could be saved, and not otherwise. This is our work. And then, again, in miscellaneous writings, will you doff your Lavender Kids zeal and become real and consecrated warriors? Will you give yourself wholly and irrevocable. Thank you. To the great work of establishing the truth, the gospel, and the science, which are necessary to the salvation of the world from error, sin, disease, and death. Answer it once and practically, and answer aright. We have to do this now. This is no fooling around, and if we don't, who will? And it would appear that, you know, whoever gets elected in the American presidency, half our country's going to be upset with it, half of it won't. So what's that all about? Anyway, we pray and know that God will place the best for the moment. And now we're going to end with this, which Nancy had given to us a while ago.
This is from the dailyverse.knowingjesus.com. Not sure what that is, but it's about Romans 13, verse 1, quote, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." And it goes on, "God is in control. Whatever the circumstances of your life or the decisions made in the global corridors of earthly rule, God is firmly and eternally in control, both of your life and over the governments of the world. And he has scheduled a time when he will put all principalities and powers under his feet. Despite the policies of politicians, the regulations of religious leaders, and the dictates of both national and international dignitaries under whom we are currently placed, we have an assurance from the authoritative word of God that he is in control and has authorized every authority to carry out his eternal plan and purpose. He does this so that Christ is all, and Christ will be all, and in all. Down through history, we see that basest of men are often those the Lord sets in positions of authority. Let us never forget that it is the Lord Most High who remains ruler over the realm of mankind, and he uses each one to forward his perfect purpose and plan. And no matter what righteous or ungodly decisions are made in the elected establishment or any unelected shadow administration, God remains in sovereign control and will only permit men to achieve their objectives when they forward his perfect plans and purposes in his redemptive program. Paul's instruction to let every soul be subject to the higher powers can often be resisted by those who recognize the problems and corruption that is often lurking in the corridors of power. But even in those difficult times, we must never forget there is no power except that which comes from God and the powers that are or ordained by God. However difficult we find the circumstances of life within our family unit or our national boundaries, we must never forget that God uses the difficulties of life to hone and strengthen our faith and to draw us into closer fellowship with and dependence on Him.
And that can be found in our election booklet. Thank you all very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.